Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, the 27th of October, welcome, friends, into the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So today on Studio 2, we're asking, how big should the Democratic Party's tent really be? And we're going to Maine as an example. Maine Senate candidate Graham Plattner, he's a Marine, an oyster farmer, and now he's becoming a lightning rod who is testing the limits of forgiveness and electability. He has old Reddit posts that include crude, borderline racist, some sexist type jokes, and he has a Nazi-style tattoo. Yet Maine voters seem unbothered by what would have been disqualifiers just a few years ago, and he remains far ahead of his opponent in the polls. So this is igniting a national debate. How much imperfection can and should a political party tolerate, and where should the line in the sand be for Democrats? We have two guests on the show. They're going to help us unpack this, and we want to hear from you. Should the Democrats embrace imperfect candidates in order to win in 2026? And what should be disqualifying? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, leave your comments in the chat. And Avi, I know this is something you wanted to talk about because your timeline was just lit up with debates on this topic.
Yeah, it went from who is this guy to I have an opinion on it in about 24 hours. So it's a fascinating topic. I also want to note that one of our guests this hour is Connor Lamb.
Yes.
Who you might remember ran against a guy named John Fetterman for
Gotta
the U.S.
Throw that
Senate.
Out there.
And there are shades of that race in what's happening now in Maine. So we might talk about that in the Maine segment today. Again, we want to hear from you. Should the Democrats embrace imperfect candidates to build a broader coalition? Just how imperfect? What should be disqualifying? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. But first, a trio of local news stories. And we start with a scary and tragic weekend at Lincoln University in Chester County. Saturday night, gunfire broke out at a campus event being held for homecoming weekend. One person was killed, six others wounded. All of the wounded are expected to survive. There is one person in custody, but officials say they believe there were multiple shooters at this event. They also believe this was not a planned mass shooting, but rather the result of an incident that took place during this homecoming event on campus. The man killed was Jawan Jeffers, 25-year-old from Wilmington, Delaware. Classes are suspended today at Lincoln.
Yeah, and they have one man in custody. That man had a gun, but authorities have not confirmed whether that gun was actually involved in the shooting. And by the way, Lincoln University has been providing in-person counseling services and a 24-hour hotline for anyone who needs report. And this hour, they are holding a community gathering on campus for students and faculty to reflect, connect, and heal. Because like you said, this is a very scary incident. It's a nightmare for a lot of folks. This was supposed to be fun.
Yeah,
this homecoming. Everybody comes back on campus, and instead, you know, it turned into a tragedy.
Yeah, just it adds that feeling that you can't feel safe anywhere when there's sort of this was apparently a very crowded, packed scene. And the like you said, sort of fun and festive nature of this event. And that just layers on another, you know, just a sense of fear connected to this entire event.
For sure, for sure. Our second story today, corporate investors bought up over a quarter of Philadelphia's single family homes over the course of about 6 years, and it is having an impact on our local housing market. Interesting story done by WHYY Plan Philly's Aaron Mozell, and it digs into a new study from the Reinvestment Fund, which shows that between 2017 and 2022, corporate interests snapped up houses in mostly Black and Hispanic neighborhoods like Germantown, Cobbs Creek, Parkside, and Brewerytown. And instead of flipping the homes or developing them for resale, these entities mostly operate as landlords. These are large and small LLC investors. They're more likely to have code violations, according to this study, than traditional homeowners. The larger investors were more likely to charge higher rents and file for eviction than smaller investors. And many of these homes were bought up in groups, like packages, which means they were probably bought at a lower price. And records show that some of these companies sought renovations and upgraded the properties to then turn and rent it out.
Yeah, interesting story by Aaron. Interesting study by this group. Look, I have some clear red flags here, right? Mm-hmm. Because Philly has a pretty high home ownership rate.
52%, yeah.
Could that undermine this? Could it make homes more unaffordable? Could it push out long-term residents? And then the flip side of it is that, as you mentioned, a lot of these seem to have been like, you know, lower value properties that were in desperate need of reinvestment to make them, you know, livable to... And of course, you know, you don't want blight in a neighborhood as well.
Yeah, for sure.
And so there's some competing interests here. One thing I thought was interesting in the report, because we hear this term like large investors, institutional investors, you might be thinking about some of these really big like private equity firms that have been buying up real estate in other parts of the country. The report did not really find evidence of that yet in Philadelphia. I'll say yet. Like Tricon, Blackstone, Invitation Homes, some of these huge institutional investors were not really active in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And they could be at some point, but it's there is like a shade of a difference between that and the institutional investors that are being described in this particular report.
Yeah, and I'll mention one more thing before we move on is people forget that Philadelphia's housing stock is really old.
Yep.
And so there's been efforts in many of these communities to sort of rehab them so that people can actually use them because there was a lot of vacant properties that needed some work and it wasn't being done fast enough. And some people say, hey, maybe this will help speed up the process and provide housing, much needed housing.
Sure,
for people.
Certainly. And there's a housing shortage, right? Yeah. I also point out that they did go back, I think, to 2012 in this report, just to look at what percentage of home sales are to these, you know, investors. In 2012, it was about 20%, so one in five. Then it spiked up to 27% in 2019, but it's actually come back down since then to 23% in 2022. So it's possible that there was a little peak here.
And then now, yeah.
Because housing crisis and the recession, there might have been a lot of cheap property available, right? And now maybe it's sort of stabilizing again. So just something to keep an eye on as well. Speaking of real estate, oh, baby, this is an interesting story. So the most expensive home listed on the Jersey Shore right now is in Avalon. It's got a home gym, infrared sauna.
Sounds great.
Whatever that is. I don't actually know what that is. A 300-bottle wine room. Mm. And to buy it, Cherry, you only need $26 million.
Only.
Or if you prefer, 240 Bitcoin.
Okay.
And that's because according to the Philadelphia Business Journal, this Avalon mansion and one other very pricey property on the shore may be the first on the Jersey Shore to accept cryptocurrency as payment. Mm. This is part of a larger trend in luxury real estate, allowing these crypto kingpins to convert their digital dollars to hard assets. And there are some pros and cons to that, as you might imagine. But apparently, according to this story, this is not something we'd really seen on the Jersey Shore before. And now it seems to have arrived. So if you want to buy this mansion, just got to fork over some Bitcoin.
So interesting to me because, you know, the CoinDesk called October one of the most destructive months in recent memory for some crypto investors, right?
Destructive.
Destructive because, oh, no. You know, just 3 weeks ago, Bitcoin, like, you know, hit a record high and then it crashed.
It's always doing that, though, is it not?
It's constantly and it's not as stable, you know, a currency as one might think. So while you may want to buy something with Bitcoin, the question is, do you want to sell something and accept Bitcoin as payment,
right?
Especially for something that's real, like you spent money building a $26 million property. And that $26 million in Bitcoin may not be worth $26 million tomorrow.
It's interesting. And it just, I think what it speaks to is this larger attempt to normalize cryptocurrency.
Yeah, they're trying.
As a form of exchange, because we had a whole show about this, right? And it sort of started in some ways as just like an internal system, right? You can, the value of it fluctuated, but it kind of was based not on nothing, but sort of just on speculation within the marketplace, right? But all of a sudden, when you start exchanging it for real assets, it becomes more like a real world currency and does seem to be moving in that direction. One thing that buying a cryptocurrency allows is it allows total anonymity for the purchaser.
So
you could sell a home to someone and have zero idea of who they are.
Like, not even my neighbor.
Exactly.
Who's my neighbor?
Exactly. And there were ways to do that before through LLCs, but you know, you can trace LLCs. You can sleuth out who's behind an LLC. But apparently these cryptocurrencies, it's like, who knows who they are?
And the thing is, this could become normalized. But the question is, do you want to be the first wave of people?
Yeah, I don't know.
To see what happens. I don't know.
Well, look, how about this? Someone send me 240 Bitcoin. I'll try it out.
I'll
be the guinea pig. I'll buy the mansion.
Look at you providing services.
I'm taking one for the team, guys. So the big show today is all about the big tent in the Democratic Party and just how big it should be. A Senate race in Maine is testing the limits. We'll talk about it on the other side of this break. Give us a call if you have thoughts. 888-477-9499.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back now to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. After their 2024 election disaster, there was a lot of talk about what Democrats should do. They should move left. They should move center. They should get younger, cooler. Maybe they need their own Joe Rogan or something.
Yeah, something like that. Could never quite follow the logic on that one. But think pieces in the world cannot prepare you for reality. And it arrived this month in the form of a Senate candidate from Maine. Graham Plattner is a Marine veteran and oyster farmer with facial scruff, vocal gruff, and a penchant for making the kind of tough guy soundbites that go viral.
He also has an internet history full of comments that range from questionable to outright offensive. And until recently, he had a tattoo that bore a striking resemblance to a Nazi symbol. What should Democrats do now? Ditch him? Or forgive them?
The Plattner controversy speaks to a larger struggle within the Democratic Party, and it's not as much about policy as image. In the Trump era, Dems have largely been the party of norms and decency. Is that just a losing recipe? And if so, what flaws are forgivable? We've got two great guests with us to discuss this hour. Tyler Austin Harper is a Maine resident, staff writer at The Atlantic, and co-host of the podcast Time to Say Goodbye. Tyler, thanks for being here.
That's a pleasure. Thanks so much.
And we also have Connor Lamb on the line. Connor Lamb is a former U.S. representative, Marine veteran, and a lawyer at Klein and Spector. Connor, nice to see you again.
Great to be back. Thanks.
Yeah, and for our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere, we invite you to participate in the conversation. Should the Democrats embrace imperfect candidates in order to win in 2026? And what should be disqualifying? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, leave your comments in the live chat.
Tyler, you are going to have to get some of our listeners up to speed here on this whole firestorm around Graham Plattner, because, you know, we're down here in Pennsylvania. We're kind of following what's going up on up there in Maine, but maybe not as closely as you all. So let's get a little of the backstory, because you went through Plattner's internet comment history. You spoke with him at length as all of this was breaking. What did he say on the internet, sort of the highlights and the lowlights? And what has been his response to the revelation of those comments?
Yeah, so in Plattner's Reddit archive, where he wrote under the name P. Hustle, he made some comments which have been reported on and brought to light, some of which were homophobic, you know, using gay as the punchline of jokes, and in one case using a homophobic slur, you know, asked a question about why Black people seem to tip less than other demographic groups. And I think the most troubling were a series of comments he made questioning the prevalence of sexual assault, particularly in the military, around 2013. You know, talking to him, his story about this was that he, you know, was coming out of a tough time. He had just done a particularly brutal tour in Afghanistan from 2010 to 2011, gets out of the military in 2012, and is just really struggling with PTSD that, you know, by his characterization, doesn't really see or understand as PTSD yet, right? Like, he's struggling with this idea that he's struggling in the first place, you know? And like a lot of men, you know, he turns to Reddit, where he vents some of his frustrations online, and then, yeah, makes some comments that are certainly regrettable. I think, you know, the one case he was making is that he's always been, you know, anti-bigotry and a kind of more liberal-minded person. And I went back through his entire Reddit history to try to sort of come to grips with, okay, what is he really a bigot online? And yes, there are some really regrettable comments in there. There's also a lot of really progressive comments, right? Like going back to 2012, he's complaining about the Defense of Marriage Act and homophobia in the military. And you see these kind of comments sprinkled throughout, you know? So I think speaking specifically of his Reddit history, right, it raises a question that I think we've grappled with at various points in recent memory, which is, you know, do we judge somebody by the best comments they've made online or the worst ones, right? Yeah. That's not always an easy answer.
Now, there's the other controversy here about the tattoo, and I'm going to bring in a caller now who has a question about it. Just to set this up, he's had this tattoo on his chest since he was a teenager. He says he got it when he was drunk one night in Croatia, I believe, while he was in the service. And the skull in question, the tattoo skull in question, bears a striking resemblance to a Nazi symbol. So Camille from Chester Heights is on the line. Camille, you're on Studio 2. I think you have a question about this tattoo controversy. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. Sure. Yes, I am a Chester Heights resident, but up until this last election, I was actually a Maine voter. I lived there for more than 10 years. So I still have a lot of connections to the area, have been aware of Graham Platner for quite some time, and was really excited about his candidacy when it was first announced a few months ago. And so obviously a little upset by this, you know, potential Nazi connection or you know, hidden Nazi sentiment he may have or sort of may have had. So my big question about it, and I haven't seen any of the news reports cover this, is he claims that he was out with fellow Marines drunk abroad, as you said, and got these tattoos, which is completely, you know, sort of believable, understandable. But I'm wondering if there are any of his fellow Marines have come forward to corroborate the story.
Yeah, thank you for that question.
It just reminds me, you know, when John Kerry, when there was questions about what John Kerry service, there were Marines that came out of the woodwork, you know, that hadn't talked to him in 20, 30 years, and they could still say, oh, I remember that night he was there and this happened. And yeah. I haven't heard of any Marines coming forward yet to say I was there too, or I remember the next morning seeing it or anything like that.
Got it. So Tyler, what have you found in your reporting about sort of the backstory of this tattoo?
Yeah, so you know, Platner's claim is that he, on shore leaving Croatia, he's coming out off of a I think quite awful 2006 tour in Ramadi. He's with some of his friends who he had you know, been a machine gunner alongside in Ramadi. They, you know, his story is that they had, you know, lost some friends, other friends were wounded, and they got this tattoo as a kind of commemorative thing while they were drunk on shore leave in Croatia. They just, you know, in his account, picked a scary looking skull off the wall because it looked cool, didn't know about the association with the Nazi symbol, etc. He claims he never found out afterwards until 3 weeks ago when it was brought to his attention by, I believe, a reporter. You know, and I think the central question here around the believability of that is, you know, on the one hand, you know, Platner's a history buff. He's into military history. You know, did he really never figure out what the symbol meant? On the other hand, you know, I have talked to a combat veteran I'm friendly with. I've read some other Marines in particular who served during the Great War on Terror, like Platner. One, who absolutely believe the story about him being drunk, but two, who have said these kind of skulls were really all over the Marine Corps in that time period, particularly during the Great War on Terror. So they, you know, some people seem to find it believable that he wouldn't have viewed it in that context, but rather in this other Marine Corps context. You know, I don't know. You know, I think a lot of this comes down to what you believe. I mean, from my point of view, how I've thought about this is, you know, as someone who's actually done the work of going through his Reddit history, you know, that's a place where he can post anonymously. I've kind of operated under the assumption that if he had Nazi sentiment, he would have felt comfortable enough sharing it under an anonymous Reddit account. You don't see any of that there. The comments he makes about Nazis are to express enthusiasm at various points for times the U.S. military has killed them. So, you know, I didn't see much evidence there of somebody who's held Nazi sentiment. Whether you believe that he never found out and chose to keep the tattoo or not, you know, I think that's a more open question to me.
Yeah. And by the way, you've written, Tyler, that you were willing to look past the ugly post and tattoo. I want you to talk about why, but then also explain what Maine voters have said or are feeling in response to these revelations.
Yeah. So, I mean, the reason, look, I want to be painfully clear. We don't know what else may or may not come to light regarding Graham Plattner, right? So, like, but on the evidence we currently have available, my view is basically, I haven't seen anything in his Reddit history that persuades me that he's ever been a bigot or had anything other than consistently liberal-ish views, at least since 2009 when his Reddit history starts, right? Before that, I don't know, but at least since 2009, I don't see that much evidence of that. And so from my point of view, given that I have yet to see evidence that persuades me he's ever been a far-right bigot, I think this is an important election for the Democratic Party, right? And the question is, who can beat Janet Mills? And that feels like a very important question to me, right? Janet Mills is arguably, by some metrics, the least popular Democratic governor in America. She's 77 years old at the time when age is a uniquely, a unique vulnerability and sore spot within the Democratic Party, right? So like the things I'm weighing as a Maine voter, right, are who can win? And do I believe this is a person that has an actual history of holding these right-wing views?
Yeah.
And as of now, with what we know so far, the answer to that is no. And I'm also not really persuaded Janet Mills can win. And so for that reason, you know, I'm for now willing to overlook this.
And in just, terms of just to clarify, Mills is the other Democrat in the race. They're, mm-hmm. They would both be looking to unseat Susan Collins, who is the longtime incumbent and a member of the Republican Party.
Yeah. And so I want to bring you into the conversation, Connor, because now that we've set the we've laid the foundation with Tyler's reporting and thoughts on this, I want to get your take because, you know, just a few years ago, this type of information being revealed would have had a totally different reaction. Because right now in Maine, right, you know, Plattner is double digit points ahead of his opponent. And it seems like Maine voters do not care about this tattoo, do not care about these Reddit posts. I want to get your take on this.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just happened. So I think sometimes in the media, we forget it. It takes a while for things like this to percolate in and show up in like an actual public opinion poll. So I would just kind of set that aside for the moment. I think the way that I look at it is, there are important things about political candidates when it comes to character that I don't think have that much to do with the kind of right, left, moderate spectrum. And so what Tyler very admirably did here was take seriously Graham's Reddit posts and look for consistent threads throughout to give an accurate reporting of like, what do these really show? And what it shows, I think, has to do with intellectual positions that he holds, which I would distinguish from character issues. And so you were making kind of a light analogy to what happened in Pennsylvania in 2022. You could look at it in similar ways. Like I was criticizing Fetterman sometimes during that primary for policy views, when I think when we look back on it now, we know that really the gaping, well, this is my opinion, maybe we don't all know this, but yeah, the gaping issue that should have been obvious was the character issue, which is sort of lack of consistency, willingness to change your views for convenience sake. And with Plattner, that's what I would be looking at, not so much is he too far left, is he, you know, is the history disqualifying? It's more, how do you handle it when it comes up? And I, you know, he puts out a 5-minute video in which the words "I was wrong" don't seem to appear. That's kind of what I would want to know as a voter. I may not have 5 minutes to watch the video. I want to know, do you understand you were wrong or not? And yeah, that's not coming through as clearly to me.
I just want to go back and revisit that 2022 race. So for folks that don't remember, Connor Lamb was among the folks who ran against John Fetterman in the Senate primary. John Fetterman obviously won and then went on to beat Mehmet Oz. Now he's in the Senate and y'all have been following the story from there. It's so fascinating now to go back and look at what was just sort of taken as gospel in the analysis of that race, Connor, one of which one plank of that is that Fetterman was running to the left of you. Now, I do think it's fair to characterize some of your record as moderate, but I do wonder how you think that idea of Fetterman as progressive or to the left settled into reality during that race. Was it his actual policy positions, or was it simply the way he looked and the way he talked, mm-hmm. and the way he specifically tweeted? I'm curious about your analysis now looking back.
Well, yeah, I think it was definitely the way he talked and tweeted and looked. All that was part of it. It was, you know, also a reflection of the policy issues he chose to emphasize during his career. He had no policy accomplishments to speak of, so it was really a question of what did he choose to elevate? And the answer to that really was marijuana, trans rights, and then to a certain extent, Medicare for all. That kind of was his deal with Bernie, I think, back in 16. So I think it was fair to say he was running to the left. He also, everywhere we went, promised to always be the 51st vote for the Democrat, no matter what the issue was, which I actually wasn't even willing to say. I was like, well, I'm going to try to take it issue by issue, do the best I can. Most of the time, obviously, I'm going to be with the Democrats, but I'm not afraid to break either. So that it was fair to say he was to the left of me. I think what I'm trying to say now is I think there were character issues everyone can look back and see where you hear all these people now who are also to the left of me saying maybe we should have thought about a different candidate because character matters separate and apart from left versus moderate.
So interesting. Yeah.
There's a comment from Matthew on this whole point. Matthew says it's wildly inappropriate. They're even referring to a man with a Nazi tattoo as an imperfect Democratic candidate. Goes to show how far the framing questions on base levels of civility have degenerated. Plattner has demonstrated incredibly poor judgment here, not even having the tattoo removed before running for Senate, and that is as disqualifying as the tattoo itself. Fetterman's tenure in the Senate and his abandonment of the Democratic base has shown the importance of not looking past these kinds of red flags. But I guess I'm still a little confused about what are these red flags? Like, we're trying to draw these lines about, we're trying to, I guess, figure out whether people are consistent, whether they believe what they say. And I don't even know how you go about doing that, Tyler. Like, you're there, you're a voter, you're trying to do that. And it has become increasingly common, I think, for people to run who have very little, like, actual resume, which I think leaves the voter in a vulnerable position of trying to figure out what is true and versus what the person is just saying at that time. I'm curious if you could help us parse that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the case of, so I would just say that I agree with Connor about the question of separating the views from the questions about character. And I think that's important. I think we saw that with Fetterman. And I agree that the writing was on the wall there. And maybe more people should have taken it seriously. In this particular case, again, you know, I will say, obviously, we are more than what we post online, right? So it is perfectly possible that, you know, Plattner has or has held a more far right or whatever other kind of very disqualifying views in his private life that aren't showing up on this online history. But in terms of consistency, you know, he is somebody from my reading who gets more liberal certainly over time, but really from the beginning, you know, most of the things he's saying online are to the sort of liberal and left end of the spectrum, even as early as, you know, 2010 or so, right? So I do think there's a fair amount of consistency there. I mean, I think there are a series of other questions we want to think about in terms of disqualification, right? A really important one seems to me, beyond has he ever held far right views, right? Like things like, why did he keep the tattoo, right? And did he ever find out? And does he have, did he keep it because he really sees it as this thing that it's not associated with Nazism and that a lot of his fellow Marines have, or is there some other kind of explanation, right? So I, you know, to the listener's point about it's grotesque that we're even entertaining this idea that a Nazi tattoo would not be disqualifying. I mean, my response would be, I think this whole thing hinges on whether we believe Plattner ever saw it as a Nazi tattoo or not, or if he just saw it as this you know thing that a lot of other Marines in the Great War on Terror also got, you know. And I think that's an important question. It's not an easy one to figure out either. I mean, at a certain point, all you can do is look at the available evidence and make your best guess there.
Yeah. And by the way, I want to remind our listeners at home, on the road and elsewhere, that you too can participate in this conversation. Our questions are, should the Democrats embrace imperfect candidates in order to win in 2026? And what should be disqualifying? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop your comments in the chat. Akram on YouTube says, I haven't personally settled on an answer on forgiving Plattner specifically, but regardless, I think the Democratic Party would be best served by letting voters decide. They put their finger on the scale for Clinton in 2016 and it backfired. By the way, I want to go back and I want to bring Connor back to the conversation because you mentioned something in your last comment. You talked about, you know, some analogies between Fetterman. He had, you know, no policy accomplishments. He had this look saying certain things online. And I want to dig into what people should be looking for, because as the Democratic Party sort of widens its tent and invites new people in, how do you vet these people? Like, how do you decide whether or not a candidate actually stands for the same ideals that the Democratic Party is supposed to stand for?
Well, one area where I agree with your caller, and I guess probably agree with the Plattner campaign, is the primary voters should vet these people. It shouldn't be Chuck Schumer and his operation or anything like that. It's up to the voters. And this is what we're doing right now is part of the vetting. An issue has been raised by the Mills campaign and Plattner needs to answer for it. I think what I'm trying to do is encourage the voters, to the extent any of them are listening, to, you know, not be afraid to demand that this person admit that he was wrong and ask for forgiveness. That's okay. And I think it's a good thing. I think what happens a lot of times in our party is Trump gets away with everything. No one seems to apply character tests to him. And so the natural reaction is to say, well, we don't have to do it either. Why impose a heavier standard on ourselves than he has? And I still think that standard is worth something.
Yeah. But a quick follow up to you, Connor, because I really am getting at this thing, because a lot of voters, they don't know. I mean, all they know is what the person has said, right? And so I wonder if, as a voter, like, what should you even, if you're trying to make this decision, are there things you would look at to say, okay, this is how I decide, this is how I make this decision? Because a lot of folks just have no idea. They don't know this person. He doesn't have a record. He's an oyster farmer, right? Comes from a family, you know, dad is a lawyer, granddad was an architect, but all you have is what you can see, right? You don't really even know.
No, that's definitely true. But, you know, we're having this conversation in October of 2025. There's a very long time until the primary election in Maine. And, you know, it's a smallish state where people get a chance to meet their candidates in person if they want to take that chance. There's a first time for every candidate. The first time I ran against an experienced state legislator who said, this guy isn't tested. You don't know what he'll do, if he can live up to it, et cetera. People took a chance on me based on what they saw of how I conducted myself during the campaign. So, you know, if I was advising Plattner, I'd say, get out there, do what Bill Clinton did in 1992 when he was accused of all these, you know, things, and just face people head on and answer their questions and don't be afraid to admit you were wrong. That's the character test that the voters get to make.
Let's bring in another caller now. This is Eric from Germantown on the line. Hey, Eric, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Just an overall comment. I just feel like we are, look at the Republican Party at large. There isn't a rule book anymore. Nobody's following rules whatsoever for any candidate that chooses to run. We have a voice that's coming out, even though a small state, somebody who's actually speaking the language that the people need to hear. And I don't understand why we would even debate questioning who we run in that, for any of these positions, when the Republican Party has literally had no rule book for years. So just a comment. I feel like you've just commented on it prior to this, but
no, it's a fair thing to add, Eric. And can I just add to that? Because I heard your response, Connor, which is that, you know, we can't just say, well, the Republicans have thrown out the Democrats can't, you know, say the Republicans have thrown out the rule book. We should too. But I think the flip side of that is that, not to say that Democrats need to support Plattner specifically, but that they need to engage in fewer purity tests overall. And they need to seek out candidates with warts to show Americans that they understand, you know, what sort of the average person thinks and feels like and goes through in their life. I mean, Bernie Sanders, an early Plattner supporter, said, I suspect that Graham Plattner is not the only American to have gone through a dark period. It's not just that you throw out the rule book. It's that you actually actively want candidates, Connor, who seem to reflect the rough edges of the average person. I mean, is that something that Democrats need to seek out?
Seek out. Yeah, maybe. And I think that, you know, look, Graham has gotten a lot of advantages so far, a lot of fundraising and also support from very prominent people. So, you know, I think to the extent anyone was supposed to be seeking out him out, that has happened. The question now, though, is all of this stuff obviously is going to get raised in a general election campaign against Susan Collins. And we're going to really find out then if people who are not very online Democrats, but are still average people, can relate to him and all his warts. So it's an important conversation to have on the front end. You can't just look past it like it doesn't matter at all.
Yeah. Ruth says a lot of what's going on with Democrats is that the old guard is scared of the up and coming younger Dems. They have new ideas and new directions. They want to take the party. No convicted criminal should be supported. No one who regularly insults opponents instead of having actual ideas should be supported. These are among the most important things for me. We have another caller on the line, Kimberly from Collingswood. Kimberly, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is that none of these candidates, no one is perfect. And the difference is some people get caught saying things that they mean and others don't. But in the current administration, we have someone at the top who lies consistently and does exactly the opposite of what he says. And my rule of thumb is always watch what people do, not what they say.
Thank you. That's Kimberly from Collingswood. And so, Tyler, when you think about how things have shifted from just a few years ago, I think about when the rise of the Me Too movement, Democrats were like, you got to step down. If anything came out, a lot of times Republicans would hold the line and they wouldn't resign or anything like that. I wonder what you think and how you've seen things shift and become more permissive just in politics generally. And, you know, how, you know, Democrats have sort of held the line a little longer, but now they're realizing that it's time for somewhat of a shift. Your thoughts, Tyler?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really true. And you can look at how the whole Democratic Party has responded to this controversy, which is mostly they've stayed out of it. Or we've seen Senator Chris Murphy yesterday even post the tattoo saying, you know, he's made some mistakes in his past, but he's, you know, someone with who seems to have a good vision, so on and so forth. I mean, no one in the Democratic Party has yet called on him to drop out, and at least as of, you know, this morning, my understanding. And that is shocking if you consider where we were just a few years ago, you know. And I think it's because of the polling, right? He's up anywhere from 20 to 30 points in the polls thus far. Who knows how the public is going to metabolize this scandal? But I also think it's out of a sense that, you know, the most important question right now is winning, right? Can we, you know, we are in a moment where it feels like the current administration is increasingly, you know, on the trajectory of being more and more authoritarian. And I think there's a bit of a rubber meets the road element too, where people realize they can't just stand on symbolic language anymore. And they have to be serious about, like, do we want power or not, right? And where the line is on what disqualifies a candidate. I mean, you know, obviously that's a debate to be had, but I think the top line issue for a lot of Democrats, both voters and it would seem, you know, Democratic politicians is, you know, how do we win, right? And I think there's a little more reticence to apply these purity tests, particularly if it's going to come at the expense of you know, unseating a Republican.
When it comes to image and how a politician presents him or herself, I do think there's a sense out there. We can see it in Ted Cruz's beard or Chris Murphy's beard that you have to look a little scruffier. You cannot, frankly, look like you, Connor Lamb. You know, you're pretty clean cut. And I'm just curious, like, you haven't got, you know, gone out and grown a goatee. So I'm just curious if you feel like, hey, I present myself the way I present myself and I'm not going to change just because times are changing. Or you just view this as cyclical. And at some point people are going to go back to, you know, yearning for politicians who both in the way they talk and in the way they present, don't seem to be, you know, cosplaying as, you know, working class. I'm just curious how you think of that personally as someone who I feel like hasn't necessarily gone with the trend on kind of the John Fetterman trend, dressing down, you know, with goatee, and shaved head, all that kind of stuff. Like why you choose the path you choose.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you have to remember that I had four campaigns in 4 years. And it was three of them were House campaigns. So it was very on the ground campaigning in very, very working class Trump friendly area. So I was up close and personal with a lot of these types of people and I got their votes. That's how I got elected in a district that Trump won by 19 points. And my biggest takeaway was they want to know, are you being yourself? Are you consistent with yourself? And what you're looking at right now is who I am. I basically dress how I dressed at an all-boys Catholic high school in 2001 and have never stopped. We had to shave there. I had to shave in the Marine Corps. It's, you know, it's just who I am. So I've never really criticized John as being inconsistent with himself, nor does it seem like Graham is being that inconsistent with himself. I think the question, though, is when you get into like an actual Nazi tattoo, and you're not willing to say that was just wrong of me to do, and it was wrong of me to keep it all these years and be forced into covering up in the middle of a campaign, that starts to feel like you're not really being yourself, because the guy that they've built Graham up to be is like sort of sensitive and historically aware and cares about the right thing, and it seems inconsistent. So that's kind of the point that I would make about that.
Is it your position, though, that image, the type of superficial image that we're talking about, simply does not matter? Because I look at a Graham Plattner and I'm like, well, isn't that how he got here so quickly? Like, yes, he's charismatic, I get that. But if he was charismatic and didn't have the goatee and the little ears pierced and wearing the flannel shirt, like, would he have actually gotten to this place? And if the answer to that is no, Connor, then can politicians afford to not follow some part of that playbook if they want to, you know, get elected to wider office?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. In the sort of social media algorithmic, very image-based era, you know, there's even scholars talking about how we're returning to an oral culture over a written culture. I think that an image like Fetterman or Graham sort of gives them a leg up and a path through the door. I think what I'm saying, though, is the whole thing is more of an art than a science. So I think that's right. Just one ingredient among several.
Fair point. Yeah.
And by the way, I want to piggyback on that because, you know, Plattner sort of presents himself as a working class populist in a lot of ways. He's a Marine turned oyster farmer, but his family background doesn't seem to line up with the whole working class roots. I mean, his father was a lawyer, grandfather was a famous architect. And so I just wonder, Tyler, what does working class actually mean to voters? Do they care about this background thing? Sure. Or do they really want folks who kind of came up from the muscle, like that the way the working class American has always been viewed, or has that shifted?
Well, you know, I mean, I think, and I won't, you know, claim to speak for all of Maine. I am actually from the great state of Pennsylvania.
Okay. Yes.
But did leave, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, well, sneaking a Go Birds one.
Yeah, there it is.
But, you know, I think that's a really fair question, right? He had a privileged upbringing. After, you know, he went to a fancy private school, he joined the military. He didn't finish college. He has, you know, worked blue collar jobs from bartending to being an oyster farmer to being a soldier for his entire adult life. You know, he was a non-commissioned officer. And so I think, you know, the question is, well, do you think somebody's class status is predicated on, you know, where they grew up and who their parents were? Or do you think it's predicated on what their jobs have been for the last 10 or 20 years? And I think you could come down either way, you know. But I do want to address, I mean, since we're talking about this question of like the symbolism of adopting these working class and so on, that's obviously part of Plattner's appeal. But I think it's important to emphasize, right? We have Mamdani in New York, who's also had a similar meteoric rise. He is not aping these sort of like working class signifiers in the same way. What these people both have in common is they hate the Democratic Party, and they're speaking to voters, including Democratic voters who are white hot angry at the Democratic Party for running a candidate who was way too old for office, who the voting base felt was way too old for office, and who have not stood up to Trump in any meaningful way, right? And so, like, from my point of view, yes, look, he has the oyster farm and the nice photos by the water and the flannels and the beard and the pistol shooting and everything else, and I think that's part of his shtick. But I think an underrated part of what is making these candidates popular is that they are willing to say that the Democratic Party is not standing up for Trump. They have fumbled the ball constantly. We are in a perilous moment in no small part because of the failures of the party establishment. And I think that's one of the reasons why Plattner is weathering this storm so far. It is not because voters don't care about Nazi tattoos. It is not because people in Maine don't care about homophobia or bigoted comments. It is because a lot of people, and if you just talk to regular people, a lot of them are so mad at the Democratic Party. And they all, this to them, this pales in comparison to the fact that, you know, the Democratic establishment, who many people see Janet Mills as a vehicle of, she is Chuck Schumer's preferred candidate in this race. A lot of people just aren't having it, right? So I think there's only so much we can glean from like the aesthetics of this race and how much of it is just that he's running messaging against the party, which is popular.
But as we wrap up, I do have to note and I have to remind folks, we're talking about a Democratic primary right now. We're not talking about a general election. And Susan Collins, who isn't exactly, you know, her image is not exactly, you know, out of establishment, has been winning this seat over and over and over again. And I think for the Democrats, one of the big questions they have to ask themselves, Connor Lamb, as we wrap up, is if they embrace candidates like Plattner, does it undercut one of their big arguments in a general election against Trump and against MAGA-aligned Republicans, which is that we are the party that can uphold standards, decorums, and norms? And if they go down this slope, will they not be able to make that argument to voters anymore? In about 30 seconds, real quick, Connor.
Even less. I think that's the exact danger I'm warning about. I think Plattner could address it by being more willing to say he was wrong, but that's my concern with him.
Interesting. Well, fascinating conversation, wide-ranging conversation. We do have to wrap it up, but let me thank our guests one more time. Connor Lamb, former U.S. rep, Marine veteran, and lawyer at Klein & Spector. Thanks again for coming on the show, Connor.
Thank you.
And Tyler Austin Harper, staff writer for The Atlantic and co-host of the podcast, Time to Say Goodbye. Tyler, appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, guys.
And thank you so much to our producers, Debbie Bilder and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, to Adam Stanislavski and Tina Kalake, who engineered today's show. Thank you so much. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you again tomorrow.